taking all that business context, asset context, and risk context, and then looking at it to go, what should we fix first? Are we materially safer this quarter than we were last quarter? Where should we be making investments? Not what are our vulnerability counts? What are our patch counts? I think it's boards don't want to see that. They want to know, are we materially safer this quarter versus last quarter?
You're listening to Protect It All, where Aaron Crow expands the conversation beyond just OT, delving into the interconnected worlds of IT and OT cybersecurity. Get ready for essential strategies and insights. Here's your host, Aaron Crow.
Thank you for joining me on another episode of the Protect It All podcast. Excited to dive into this. Going to these conferences, it's amazing the people that I meet and the connections that I have and so many overlaps of the guests that I have today. Nick and I, even though we, before S4 this year, had never actually met or anything, but some of the things that we've worked on have really crossed paths and some of the things I did in the past, he's working on now. So anyways, Nick, thank you for joining me today. Why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us who you are, a little bit about yourself, and then we'll dive into the fun stuff.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it. It was really interesting to run into each other and find how many different clients and projects are overlapping. It's such a small world, not only in security, but within OT security as well. And so, I really appreciate the time. You know, I did not start in the OT space. My background was in banking, right out of school from 2000. I got into Wells Fargo. I was a business analyst, which was really a very wide-reaching title that we were doing control testing and audit validation of underwriting requirements, right, for lending in the very beginning of the whole mortgage upswing. And used to walk in and, you know, sit in my cubicle with a big tube monitor in the corner and had 2 feet tall piles of files, right, around me, like an inch and a half, 2 inch thick. And you had to go through them all manually. And you have to make sure every single control is tested, validated, you know, that there's evidence for all of that in every single file. And it was painful, which we can get into later. But, you know, I started there at a very manual process in banking all the way up to 2009. And I saw a really good maturation there because we started, rather than one file at a time, did multiple files at a time. Data ingestion, 100 tab spreadsheets, which was a big improvement for a manual version. And then we started deploying tools like Archer, right? Early GRC days, after the whole Oxley incident, right? And rollout, I should say, back in 2002. And so it was in banking, all risk and control assessments, right? It was probably the most mature, maybe still the most mature industry from a risk and security perspective for control validation audit.
Yep.
I got out of banking in 2009, like so many of us did. When we had the mortgage collapse and took a similar contract role through a staffing agency through Goodrich Aerospace Systems. And they were digitizing the brushless motors in the landing gear to the cockpit when they were modernizing all of that. You know, not only modernizing that, but pulling ashtrays out of the seats in the bathrooms, you know, when the airplanes
right.
used to happen. And it was a really exciting project. I had to get Six Sigma cert, had to go through that process. And it was really interesting to learn how much of the financial risk control and audit processes benefited the aviation industry. Completely different environment, right? We're talking about aircraft surface areas, brushless motors, electrical signals, DC controllers, all of that. And luckily passed Six Sigma cert and then Boeing bottom. And I was out of a job again. Didn't want to move to Seattle anyway, the job they offered me. And so I was like, all right, well, what would I do next? And I took a contract to another recruitment agency at San Diego Gas and Electric and started building up a team there. I think we built it up to 42 people and we deployed Archer that they had there, looked in the IT systems, the OT systems, you know, from policies to risks to controls to audit evidence collection to the security vulnerability programs and how all of that mapped to not only NIST, but multiple frameworks. Including privacy for customer data, but even in an ERCSIP, right, in TSA. And so that was a great project for several years. And after a couple years there, they decided to bring that whole team on. I think they hired 42 of us. And I just decided that time I was going to get back into consulting, but I wanted to bring that aerospace and the energy and utility experience I had over 4.5 years with the banking background for you know, 9 years. I started a consulting firm. And that was 13 years ago.
What a roller coaster. And it just goes to show, you know, I didn't come from banking, but I have done some of my background is in the banking world, enterprise, you know, about half my career is spending the enterprise side and the other half my career is spending critical infrastructure, whether it's power utility or critical manufacturing, transportation, things like that. But risk is risk, right? And it really comes down to the business risk, right? And it doesn't matter if I'm making a widget, if I'm generating electricity, or if I'm, you know, if I'm in the financial market, it's still a risk to the business. And understanding that from top to bottom, being able to quantify it, being able to understand it, being able to track it, understand where those risky assets are, the risky people, the risky processes, it doesn't matter. Like at a high level, it's really just business risk and understanding what is your business. What is the flow of, you know, the workflow of what I'm selling or what I'm creating and how do I sell those things? And what is my supply chain? And all of those things, they're universal across all these industries. And so many folks make it difficult. And yes, I need to understand the business. Like I understand power utility. It's hard to take somebody from banking and drop them into power utility and expect them to understand the business risk, but they'll understand the risk as long as there's somebody that's partnered with them that can answer, hey, this is what I'm looking for. What is that in this business? And that's how you can tie those things together. So that's where I love the conversations around this type of thing and how your background and a completely different financial and all that kind of stuff and has got you into the critical infrastructure and OT and power utility and all that kind of stuff and how it's benefited you and it's started up this consulting firm and it's helped customers and clients. And that's where all of our overlaps have happened. And I love to hear those stories and the use cases around those things.
Yeah. You know, it is hard to take people from one industry and drop them in another because they don't understand the business context, right? What business services, what's critical, what's operational. You know, one of the things when I was in school, I was in an aerospace program. Before I got into banking. So that whole program taught you, you know, year one, basics of aerospace, basics of flight. Year two was all ground school and airframe and power plant. So we actually, as a team, built a small one-person, single-engine dual-wing aircraft, right, all composite. And it flew. I didn't fly that one. But I had flown Cessnas in the past, going for my visual flight rating to be a private pilot. And so all of that, I had a lot of experience then, you know, 2 years of flight instruction. And so that experience really taught you three-dimensional risk versus driving a car. It's all, you know, two-dimensional risk. And it might be 360 degrees around you, but it's very a single plane is what I mean there. And when you're thinking through being in the air, you've got a full 360-degree sphere of risk around you at all times. And a lot of it's invisible. You got thermals, you got cooling patterns, you got the speed of the wind that'll pick up, not to mention all the other aircraft and the controlling of when you take off land and airspace that you're allowed to fly in. So it was a really interesting perspective on risk, being a student to get my pilot license. And then out of school, you can't afford flying anymore. So I hadn't flown since last day of school, in a small aircraft. But getting into banking, it was really interesting to take those the 4 years of experience of flight school, while going through my regular classes and then taking that to banking and then somehow pivoting that back to aerospace. You know, it's one of those things. One of my favorite quotes is Steve Jobs. He said, looking forward, a lot of life doesn't make sense, right? But looking back, all the dots connect. And I never would have thought, right, that pilot school, you know, with banking experience would lead to an OT security career.
Yeah. It just goes to show, and I, so many folks are reaching out constantly about how do I get into OT, how do I get into cybersecurity, all that kind of stuff, right? You know, and it really, I've had such success in hiring and building teams, and if you look at the teams that I've built in the past, most of them wouldn't have the, you know, if I gave a job description to HR and they were hiring, most of the most successful teams that I've had wouldn't have had the check boxes that HR would have required for those things to be successful to hire that person, right? So many of them had zero OT experience, meaning like none of this, or they had zero IT experience or zero cybersecurity experience, but they had something. They had troubleshooting capabilities. They had an understanding of the business. They had like, there are these these factors that we don't always think about when we're, hey, I need an OT cyber person. So we think about networking, we think about, you know, ICS and IoT and all these other things, which are absolute skill sets that we need. But there's those trump cards that are in there that are non-negotiables that we don't even necessarily know unless we've had it or we need it, that I can grab the guys with all the guys and gals that have all the certifications and all the things, but they may not have the knowledge that I'm looking for or need. And I don't necessarily always know those things. So like you coming into this industry from the background that you had, you would have never imagined, or probably the people that hired you would have never imagined, how much of an impact you could have because of the experience you had from other industries, from other backgrounds like flight and being a pilot, and how those skills and the way you approach a problem and the way you see things can actually help you in translating the risk to the business in an OT space, and how those things align. Because on a piece of paper, it's really hard to see the dotted lines between all those different things, like you said, right?
Yeah. You know, as you're talking, it reminded me, I had a great, brilliant guy who worked for me out in the Bay Area, and we're looking at universities to where could you hire and what skill sets and backgrounds did the best students have. And he said, well, Wayne, Nick, everybody looks at computer science majors, but very few people look at math majors and even less look at music majors. And he said, I'll tell you, all three equally will support a cybersecurity, that background would lend itself successfully to a cybersecurity career. And when you start thinking about the mind evolution of music majors and how they're reading music and seeing all things come together in multiple layers, right? It's, you need that coordination. You need that thought process, that visibility to see multiple different instruments playing at multiple different times at multiple different clefs. And you see how it all comes together. And I would have never thought that, right? But he was right. And we've hired some great music majors and great math majors that have done, not only will they do really good in our industry, but what I find is a lot of computer science majors want to build the next, you know, the next Twitter, the next X, the next Facebook. They come in, I want to build something. And I find there's two different kinds of people. If you take CISOs as an example, I categorize them into two groups. The CISOs that come in and assess and build a mature program where one didn't exist, and the second one that will maintain that program. And I know I'm painting with a broad brush here, but I found there's builders and managers, and you need both, right? But you got to make sure they're not in the wrong roles. And so I find, you know, thinking through the background that people need, it's also where do those people want to go? And if you're insecure, you're building programs. You're not building products. Sure. Right? You're assessing products. You're assessing how those products are implemented. You're assessing how all these devices play in harmony together and have to. And any off key there could be a vulnerability.
Right? Yeah. So diving into all of the things that you guys are working on and the problems that you guys are helping customers solve, I know it really designs it, a lot of that work goes around that the threat landscape, the asset inventories, the all of that world. How are you helping folks, and how are you guys approaching things differently and solving these problems in these, again, in these OT spaces that you know people have manual spreadsheets or, you know, things on a piece of paper that they're walking around. They have drawings that were 30 years old and haven't been updated, or maybe they're redlined, maybe they're not. Like, this is a problem we see across OT, no matter how big or small the organization is, and no matter which critical infrastructure it's in. Some may be better than others, but we have this inherent problem across all of these spaces.
You know, I think there's a couple of different layers there to unpack. First, there's been the separation, right? A firewall, if you will, between IT and OT systems many years is, and I believe there rightfully should have been. But when you have all these devices that are 30 plus years old, that were designed to last 20 years, that are starting to fail in critical areas, that are causing safety issues, loss of life in some areas with fires, things of that nature. What I find is there's more of this IT-OT convergence. And I think that's a misnomer, just because people are thinking, well, you just need one inventory and you just handle all the classes the same. And that's not what it means from what we're seeing out there. What we're seeing is, how do you have a main asset inventory, right? Like a CSDM aligned CMDB. So a common service data model alignment. And you might have your main IT asset inventories there, right? And there's ways to discover that with a lot of different tools out there. There's all kinds of IT discovery tools. and go down the list and understand how they populate that inventory. You have visibility, and then you have the risks assessed against controls that are written, against policies that are written, against frameworks or regulations. But what you do is you see a completely separate tool, a completely separate inventory for OT assets. And that can be broken down into highly regulated assets, non-regulated IT assets that are monitoring OT systems, right? And then building management systems from, you know, seismic sensors and substations to cameras, gate systems, badge scanners, automatic door locks. It's pretty interesting when you really get into the nitty gritty of it. But when you break that down, it's more of a OT asset extension table, because you need to have that data segmentation and role-based access. So only if you take electric utilities as an example, you have NERC certified people that are accessing NERC data, right? And, but you're seeing even in OT, those three types of asset classes, and that's traditional, right? You're moving that into, or mapping it to an IT asset inventory, because the CISOs that I talked to, while they might not be NERC certified themselves in many cases, want visibility into risks that those regulated assets are exposing the company to. And fundamentally, I think this just, the industry we're in is maturing. I'll take risk for an example, or GRC, and then I'll get into the OT side. I think GRC, as I mentioned, you know, was a largely invented through the old Sarbanes-Oxley issue. And then Archer came out, I think around 2002, when that was really what I call compliance-driven business decisions. Are we compliant? Are we going to get fined? Can we pass an audit? What are the regulators going to say? It wasn't a security-based program. It was a compliance-based program. And in around 2000, I think the industry for GRC matured into IRM, which is integrated risk management, which is a Gartner term. And for many years, and even still today, there are experts, pundits, you know, all kinds of people that'll say it's just another acronym. It's still the same program. And I fundamentally disagree. I think it was when industry matured from compliance-driven business decisions to risk-driven business decisions. We're able to do that by having tools that had policies and controls and vulnerability scanners attached to assets that were attached to those active inventories, right? And so if you can see real time versus what GRC was, a snapshot, a point in time. Snapshot, here's our asset inventory. You upload it in a GRC tool, or that includes, you know, policy, risk, compliance, internal audit, vulnerability, and patch management. That was really, you're running a program based on a snapshot that was old the moment the picture was taken.
Yeah.
Right. And so with IRM is more an integrated model with active asset discovery from inventory, policies that are assessed based on new threats that are happening out there and how they need to be managed internally, not just from a regulatory perspective. And it's been a really interesting life cycle to see GRC go to IRM. And with OT, we're seeing separation into more of an apartmentalized conversation, right? It's all in the same building, but you only have keys to where you need to go. So that's just been a big maturity experience that I've seen we've gone through in GRC. And now I think we're seeing that in OT converging with these inventories.
Yeah. And ultimately it needs to live at that business level. The CISO may not have understanding and visibility of an OT asset specifically and understand to the nth degree how that widget works or how the power plant works, because they may not have that background. But ultimately, somebody has to own that business risk, right? And if I'm a power utility, that business risk really is that OT asset. That is my product. That is the thing that makes the revenue. And so many times I see almost the tail wagging the dog. You know, you see a lot of GRC and a lot of focus and funding and people and process around the IT side, and rightfully so, but not the same amount of rigor and maturity necessarily in the OT side, which is where the assets and the risk and the value really is. So how can a CISO or an executive, whether it's the CEO, the CIO, whomever, how can they truly categorize and understand the risk, if they don't have visibility into those environments and understand it, at least at a high level, somebody needs to be able to put that picture together and understand, hey, yeah, these are our corporate enterprise risks. Here's our OT and our process risk. And this is the business process. And these are where these assets live. And because I see so many times these executives are accepting risk and they don't truly understand what they're accepting or what that the downstream domino effect of those risk acceptance really are until something bad happens.
I hit the nail on the head there. You know, they say being compliant doesn't mean you're secure. Being secure doesn't mean you're compliant. What do I take from that? I think that's two budgets, a compliance budget and a security budget, and risk lives in between. Right. I think compliance driven OT security is quickly becoming a liability and not a strength. And this is where the risk lens comes into. If you think of traditional risk and vulnerability patch, it's very linear. What are your policies? What do they say you have to do? Why are they written these regulations? You know, test policies, you test controls, control failures or risk control self-assessments, identify risks in a risk register. And those either become an issue, finding and maybe an issue, maybe an incident, right? Very linear. When you think about what you're just describing there, it's more tops down. What are your asset classifications, right? How are they first tied to your business services? What are the business services criticality? Who owns those processes? And then you come down into this process of, okay, well, why are we rating these assets more critical than these assets? What are the business? And so this is where I think the invention from an OT perspective integrates compliance security in what tools like RMS and other tools that are out there called CASM. And I call it CASM Lite because it's really IT asset visibility, real-time discovery, real-time inventory, real-time configuration management, real-time security posture control, real-time continuous control monitoring, right, of those assets. But historically, they've been IT assets. Then that's why I like tools like this because they focus on IT assets and IoT assets and OT assets. And they go, this is CASM. And I'm like, well, I think that's CASM Lite in my humble opinion, because you need AI assets, right? And you need AI discovery tools that are going to look at logs from like Palo Alto's or Splunk's and really identify AI usage, whether it's approved and inventoried, approved, uninventoried, or unapproved and uninventoried, effectively, you know, shadow AI or shadow IT or OT assets in these environments. And when you think through that, okay, is that CASM? Well, you need identity and access on top of that, right? Or what's now being called identity security. So you have human, non-human, and AI agent access management controls. So that's what I look at as the new maturation is you have IT, IoT, OT, and AI asset discovery in real time into those segmented data tables that can be rolled up. And then you have the identity security line on top of it. That is really saying, what do we own? Who owns it within the organization? What business services is it tied to? Is it reachable? Are there any access paths to it? Are there vulnerabilities that are being exploited out there in real time? What we do in data sharing with the InfraGuard in a utility example. Taking all that business context, asset context, and risk context, and then looking at it to go, what should we fix first? Are we materially safer this quarter than we were last quarter? Where should we be making investments? Not what are our vulnerability counts? What are our patch counts? I think it's boards don't want to see that. They want to know, are we materially safer this quarter versus last quarter?
Yeah. And it's funny when I go to these sites, I go to, you know, whether again, a lot of these different places and even ones that have an asset inventory, let's say I've got one and it doesn't matter if it's digital or if it's in a spreadsheet. So many times they're missing the point. It's the same thing. And I'll get into this in a second on tabletops, but with an asset inventory, like they'll have a spreadsheet and it says, okay, well, it's got, you know, machine name, IP address, MAC address, you know, version of OS, firmware, whatever the things are. And it's just, you know, those line items. But nothing from an outsider. I don't know what that thing is. What does it do? What is it important? Is it not important? If it goes down, is there another one? Is it under warranty? Is it, you know, like there's so many questions that are not answered in just an asset inventory with make, model, serial number, you know, that kind of stuff. And we're missing the point. And the problem is that the OT team, the operator, knows exactly what that asset is by name, by IP address, knows its function, all that kind of stuff. But that stuff is not translated into the asset inventory. So even if IT has a asset inventory that covers all of their IT and OT assets, they have no idea what HMI number one or control processor number two is, how important it is to the business. I use this analogy a lot. I can have two PLCs, and one PLC controls a turbine and the other PLC controls the ice machine in the break room. They have the same firmware. They're the same make and model, but they're not the same risk to my business, right? If the ice machine goes down, I've got some pissed off operators, but my business continues to run. If the PLC that's controlling the turbine goes down, it's a whole different conversation, and they're not the same inherent risk, even though they may have the same vulnerabilities. They may have the same, you know, operating system and all of those other things, but it's not the same risk. And that's that risk quantification that is missed so many times when I'm doing an asset inventory of a site or a system or whatever I'm looking at. Right.
Yeah. And this is where, I'll tell you a quick story. I worked with a large utility, middle of the country. And we went in on an OT visibility inventory vulnerability project. And we went in and we said, okay, well, let's look at, first off, in tabletops, what percentage of assets do you think you have visibility into? 50, about 50%. We need help. Said, okay. Went in, did a full assessment. They had a bunch of OT sensors deployed. We brought in a lot of data from that. We looked at where they were deployed, gave them some advice on where they should be deploying them in a few different other areas and some strategies around that to minimize sensor overload. Came back, they had 18% asset visibility. When we were done and left, they had over 95, right? And so that was a big wake-up call for the board. And then we'll say, okay, well, so we got discovery, we got inventory. But in inventory, it's like most, you know, you have to look at this as a site or location based, right? So what locations are these assets in? And then understanding the criticality of those assets that are being deployed there. Understanding, you know, most utilities in this example start in the middle of the corporation, and what business services do we have, and who customers do we have to service, what vendors do we have, and what about production? And where utilities want to get to is pre-approved OT asset inventory with light asset attributes that are approved. So someone needs to rack something, that asset's already approved, that's had a vendor risk assessment, as you mentioned earlier, is really moving into a deployment model. And what is that life cycle of that asset being deployed, being commissioned, having the right, you know, policies and controls in place, doing those risk assessments, ensuring security is in place, ensuring you have the right access controls at those locations as well, and that you've got life cycle management all the way through asset retiring. And when we show this life cycle to utilities, they're going, yeah, how do we get there? And it's like, well, start with visibility and inventory, right? As we talked about the CASM program, but then you can understand when you're taking vulnerability data in, and most people think of SecOps as vuln, incident response, and threat intelligence, right? But if you think about it through, I think security is maturing as well, to exposure management, not from buying SKUs of risk, security, asset inventory, like identity and access, right? It's like, okay, what's our exposure, right? Like, when you think about modern role-based access and modern dashboards and visibility into looking at it from a, I'm thinking this as like a map, right? Think about a map, get your area of your utility covers 3 or 4 states, any multiple geo services. And then you start seeing the substations or any of the asset classes that you have in these sites. And then you start to double click into those and see the assets that are there, see the business criticality scoring, and then see the vulnerabilities that are there, and then seeing the access paths to them, right? You aggregate all this data and it starts to become an equation. Going back to this is why math majors do really well in this industry. They can start calculating these and you can get exposure scores, right? Which is a total enterprise exposure index. Right. And then you can really double click and drill down into these sites to see what should we be fixing first? Why are we fixing this? You've probably seen this. I've seen tens of millions of vulnerabilities on vuln lists, right? Like, where to start? At the top, you know, it's like, no, you need to understand. Let's look at the exposure each of these have. And that's where I'm really excited about where the industry is going right now.
Yeah. And man, it's so valid. And I have very few people that are having these conversations or really understand that, right? I use the PLC analogy. So that's two PLCs at the same site, but two sites are going to have different risk profiles to my organization. And I need to categorize and classify, because again, vulnerabilities on a vulnerability list don't help me understand what the real risk to my business and organization is, because every asset is different. Every site is different. Every user, every business process within those, every system, like all, there's so many factors and categories that go into that. That into that equation of understanding where the risk is. And I need to be able to understand those and document that process or understand that process from end to end so that I can start, okay, where does this asset live? Is it more or less risky than this thing? And do we have the level of controls that we're comfortable with? And, you know, the way I've done this in the past is something like, you know, to make it simple, you know, a low, medium and high of this is a low risk to my business. If this asset goes offline, it's okay, right? If this asset goes offline, it is a big impact to our business, whether it's financial or whatever that risk is. And being able to categorize those sites, the systems within those sites, the assets within those sites, and all of those things have to really roll up to understand what that risk is at that top level. So that when you get that vulnerability list or whatever that thing is, and you say, I've got an hour to do work. What is that hour? Where should I focus that time? Whether it's an hour of work or if I need to spend money on, you know, people, process or technology, where should I point that at? Right? Because it's easy to just peanut butter spread money across an entire OT organization and hope that I'm doing good things, but am I actually impacting the things that I need to impact and moving the needle to actually get real risk reduction that's tangible and trackable and understandable in my organization? That is very hard to attain. It's really not, but you have to go through those initial processes that are not sexy and they're not, you know, buying products as much as they are really understanding your business process and bringing people in that can help you categorize and classify all those things in the right place.
Yeah. You know, people say that, you know, risk isn't, you know, the risk or GRC or IRM industry isn't sexy. I get really excited about this stuff.
I do too, as you can tell.
You know, if we take a step back to that, that utility I give an example with and left them with 95% visibility and then turn on volume for them. The question they asked in the beginning was, what happens if this doesn't work, right? What are the assumptions and dependencies you need? Well, we learned the question should have been, which is now the first question we ask every utility is, what happens when this is successful, right? Because their vids light up like a Christmas tree. They're like, hey, we had 20 people managing this. I need another 20. How do I go back to the board and tell them we invested into this automation, but I need to hire 20 more people from a remediation standpoint? Okay, well, let's look at this, right? So there's two steps. First step was, how do we take that high, medium, and low example that you gave there and say, let's use continuous controls monitoring, right, for control, compensating control mapping for control degradation over time. And let's use a continuous control mapping for the lowest resources, right? The low level risks. And we'll put some flags and some indicators in there to alert somebody if something happens there. Oversimplifying, of course. Medium, let's make sure that we're using continuous controls monitoring, but let's also make sure you're using tools like security posture controls management that make sure all the tools that you've invested in are deployed where they're supposed to. What we found is companies spend so much money on tools that are enterprise-wide, unlimited use. They're not even deployed everywhere they should be.
Yeah.
So then we make sure that happens. And then you've got configuration compliance management, right? Where, are they configured in the proper way, right? That your policies and control maps say they need to be. So if you can do that for the bottom of the second, then you take your top 20 guys and they said, actually, we don't need 20 guys anymore. We need 10 guys, maybe five, right? To focus on that 1 hour that they have on the high risk and high critical components. And they were able to repurpose those other people into different teams that also needed headcount, right? Without the increase, the human capital line there. So that was a really interesting experience that we got to see with what are you going to do when you're successful with these types of programs? You know, the other thing you mentioned there was investment, right? It's not only if I got 1 hour, but if I've got $1, right? Or $1 million, whatever the number is, how do you get the board to approve it? And we've always seen the hardest conversations are the CISO and the chief compliance officer, right? Hey, bad things aren't happening. Vuln counts are going to have batch counts are going up. We're not in the news. That's your ROI message, right? If you're a CISO. And with compliance officers, it's we're performing more risk assessments. Our confidence rating has improved on the risk that we're reporting on our 10Ks, right? But and that's it. But, you know, Gartner double-edged sword here, but sometimes they come out with some great stuff. And I think the GRC to IRM was one of them. I think asset visibility and discovery into Chasm is another, right? And I think taking this and what they have a new offering that, a new program model that they call CTEM, which we're dying through acronyms here, but it stands for Continuous Threat Exposure Management. And I did some deep dives into this, about a year ago when this came out, and started looking into the equations that they recommend to show from a security perspective. If you can show increased asset visibility from a 19 to a 95, right? And if you can show exposure indexes going down over, hey, here's our vulns, here's our business critical assets, as you described. Can we map that we're fixing the right things in the right order? Are there even access paths? Are there compensating controls? Is this asset internet facing or is it seven layers back in my network? Can we focus on the dollars we're putting on are actually reducing risk? And what Gartner was recommending there is let's map it to IBM's reach index, right? Based on industry. So what is it? 10.22 million to remediate a breach technically in the US. But it's 8 million in healthcare. It might be, 15 million in banking, right? Or 16 million in utility, but it might be 4 million in a hospital, right? So, and those numbers might be off a little bit. But if you think through that and you start looking at your industry, and that's just remediation costs, that's not bad reputation, stock price, employee loss, customer loss, confidence loss, right? And so if you can take that data from your industry and map that back to investments you're making, I believe that by the end of this year, we'll be able to see board reporting that'll be almost required that shows ROI on risk and security programs.
Well, and that's the thing that so many, especially in the OT, and it's that way all the place. I just got back from RSA and you go to every other booth is AI this and AI that, and all the new features and widgets and all the things, which all are great. I'm not bad mouthing any. I was there obviously, so I was doing some of that myself. But it really comes down to if I can't justify it and if I can't track it, like yes, it's almost like a used car salesman. You may be able to sell them and get them to buy the car. But are they going to be happy long term? Are they going to renew? Are they going to come back to you for more? Right. And to your point, you said this earlier, right? There's so many products that people buy. They install or partially install. It's in their environment. Maybe it's running. Maybe it's running on some of their assets. Maybe it's running on some of their sites. Maybe some people are using it. But, a lot of times it's not that I need to go find a better tool. Let's get the tools that we have actually deployed in the right places and get it, update our policies and procedures, make sure that we're actually utilizing them, right? Even if a tool, the other analogy I always give is like, I can have the best tools in the world. I can buy the best woodworking tools, spend $1 million buying the best products and lathes and all the stuff, but I still have to go out there and build it. Right. I have to know what I'm doing, what I want to build, know how to do it. Now, granted, we're not talking about AI yet because obviously robotics and stuff kind of goes into that. But still, somebody has to program it and I have to go out in my garage and build stuff. I can't just buy a tool, a DeWalt drill, and expect the DeWalt is just going to do the stuff for me. I still have to wield the tools. And it's no different in cybersecurity. And we still have to have those tools used and bringing value, tuning them, adjusting them, make sure they're installed, make sure they're used. We're responding and we don't have five tools that five different organizations using five different sites, which is what we see a lot of the time as well.
Yeah. From the people perspective is such an important part. When you think through the aging OT industry that we're dealing with right now, all that tacit knowledge that's going out the door when people retire. I saw a company recently that would hire these retired OT security and OT asset managers that retired and use them as a contract basis only. And the new engineers could pull out your phone, take a picture of something or video it, and some guys sitting back at home doing some advisory and some consulting. Oh, you gotta, hit it with the hammer on this side of the machine trick.
Right.
And it just highlights the issue of this knowledge that's leaving the industry. So this is where we're seeing CISOs want to hold the asset inventory. If I have to secure it, I have to own it, right? In that example we used earlier to get true visibility. And so that way they're working more with their OT and field service engineers, right? That are going out there installing these patches, maintaining these assets. And so the people are leaving, and you've got a younger generation coming in that wants to use AI for everything, and rightfully so, right? You and I were born without iPads or without internet, right? And then it was a dial-up.
Yep.
And now we're here where these kids are born with phones in their hands, you know, tongue in cheek there. But they want to use it, but the quality out of these AI systems on large language models is still very concerning. So you're getting small language models or micro language models being purpose built for this type of field service for OT asset solution. So I think that we're in this, in the convergence, not only of tech and of process evolution, but of that skill set mentorship, the old apprentice, bell graph, master of the craft concept here, where you need these junior guys coming in and you need the older guard that are mentoring them, because this is where our personnel gap is for these types of programs. You know, I think that fundamentally those knowledge bases that are out there, right, that people are finally starting to upload in OT and trying to lock down in mainly on-premise environments, maybe the FedRAMP high environments as well, that hit the nail there really well on the people side of it. We talk about process maturation, talk about where Gartner's taking it. We talk about where the technologies are integrating. But yeah, without the people, I think that there's a massive gap here if we don't address that.
Yeah, 100%. It we need all of those things, and we always have. Like it's not new. We brought all this technology into the OT space, you know, 30 years ago. This was all, you know, disconnected. It was all, you know, proprietary, all that kind of stuff. And the vendors decided, hey, this is a lot easier if I just grab commercially off the shelf equipment, Windows servers and Cisco switches and all the things, and we bring them into this. But we brought all that inherent risk with it, and we didn't necessarily understand, or the industry didn't understand enough that, hey, we're bringing all the, yes, it's easier. Yes, I have more visibility, but I also need to be bringing in the processes and the controls around those things. So we're like 10 to 20 years behind enterprise and IT in these spaces. But it also goes down to the people side. Like you said, like my dad has worked in power utility, you know, he's in his 70s now, but he worked in power utility for 40 something years before he retired. And he's still being consulted, like you just talked about, from power utility companies, because they have new engineers that are coming up, but he's the one that built the power plant that they're doing it on. So he knows where the bodies are buried, and he knows why that cable runs down to that way and why it's set up that way. Right. So they consult people like him because it's easier than it is to just completely rip it out and rebuild it. Or for a person that has no background in history in this space to be able to have to figure it out on their own, they can fast track it so much faster by bringing in somebody like my father, any of these old school guys to be the, you know, remote person that you bring the camera in and say, oh yeah, I know what that is. That's this, hit it on the side once with a hammer and, you know, hold your, you know, finger in your ear and then it'll turn on. Right. That's priceless value add to an organization. And a site, and that knowledge needs to be put in, because obviously these guys and gals are not going to be around and available forever. So we need to figure out a way to document those things, train these folks up, and be able to have that knowledge transfer. You know, or you know, that could be a really dangerous, risky environment to be in from a people process side of things.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're trying to help with. If you look at what do those people do, right? Those people that have been in the industry for decades in the OT space, and take electric utilities as an example. When one of the large utilities get audited by NERC, which are typically every 5 years or so, I watched a video the other day from one of these large utilities. I'd say maybe not even top 10, but high asset count. And they were saying that it takes them $1.5 million to go through a NERC audit, because there's 1.5 million individual tasks, and the data lives in 14 different locations and 14 different data schemas, and they have to go get it. And the first thing they do when they get an audit is request an extension, you know, because they're not going to be able to meet it in 90 days or so. And so how do you simplify that problem to give the engineers that should be doing the work on operational environments more time available to themselves? So to give them more of that availability, it's, hey, let's automate the testing. Let's automate the NERC audits for you guys to do some mock audits, so you can see where you stand before you come in. Let's get it in a place where you can literally push an easy button and pull out and automate ERT reports, right? And sending them out, because our stalls are going away, right? And all of NERC is also maturing their processes. So if you think through that, it's what's the low hanging fruit from the work no one really wants to do, right? From a compliance and audit perspective, then how much of that can we automate and take that down by 80% to, you know, 70 to 90% range and let them focus on what they're doing there? That's one thing I think we can do quickly. It also helps companies spend more of the money that they have in actually operational environments and securing those environments and making sure that their safety, number one, and uptime, number two, right? That's really what people need to see here, because if these systems go down, you're seeing, if it's summer, you see loss of life in areas like Texas. If it's winter and they had a big storm, you'll see the same thing in places like Texas. And it goes based on regions and their risk profile.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it really comes down to, you know, those things. You said it before, and one of my previous bosses and mentors used to say this, that you can have the compliance and security many times are two different targets, right? And I can be secure and not compliant, and I can be compliant and not secure, right? Because, you know, you look at a power utility and their compliance or NERCSIP compliance is only a sub fraction of their total assets that are a risk to the business, right? Only certain things hit the criteria to be a NERC asset and be part of the program by design. But on the flip side, I can be like, how do I start thinking about this differently, right? And instead of having a separate process, separate tools that are just dedicated and focused on, you know, my NERCSIP compliance, what if all of that capability were inherently built into my overall process, and that when an audit came up, I already have everything I need. It's just a matter of pointing to it and running a report or whatever. So I'm taking additional steps and tasks and different tools and products and things like that. Now, obviously, there may be some things that I need dedicated for, you know, compliance reporting, et cetera. Like, obviously, all those things are there. I don't want to oversimplify it, but I think sometimes we make these compliance programs overly complex, overly expensive, overly difficult to follow, because we didn't design the process from the beginning. Like, we're bolting on this compliance reporting and capabilities to a process that it doesn't fit. It's square peg and round hole. It doesn't fit anywhere. And instead of redesigning the process so that it just naturally flows out, we're trying to bolt it on and force it. And it makes it sometimes 10 times more difficult than it is just as I'm building this thing out. How can we adjust the process so that we get this as a natural output of our normal process?
See, if you look at, you know, the most regulated state out there, they, no surprise, they have the highest energy costs, right? How many pennies of every dollar go to regulation and compliance reporting? And they still have any issues, right, with delivering power to their clients. So I think that if you could simplify that process, not necessarily eliminate it, right? Because you work with utilities that are in U.S. territories or that are NERC aligned, but don't have to be NERC compliant, because they want to use those best practices. They want to use that structure. Even when TSA came out with, you know, Table 3 in their cybersecurity program recommendations and framework, it nearly mirrored NERC, SIP, right, specifically. And now they're rolling out 15. I don't think it's going to be rolled out to 2030, if I read that right recently. But that's looking at operational resilience from all the other areas. And I like NERC as an example, because you got asset inventory requirements, and that's asset visibility inventory. Then you got personnel and training. So there's HR in your training. Then you've got security as your security suite. Then you got access controls with your identity suite, right? Then you need the vendor suite, right? And the hardware, software, bill of materials components there. So customers need to meet this requirement, whether it's regulatory or they're just aligned for their internal framework. They have to buy 5 different tools and implement them. That's where I think a lot of the complexity and the cost comes in there, right? That exacerbates the cost to the customer that quickly get passed on. And every year, the public utility commissions get requests for rate increases and they have to justify them. That's a whole nother investment of time, effort, and money just to assess and report and request a rate increase. So it starts to compound itself in an exponential fashion that just gets passed on to the consumer. I think that's really important right now because of these AI data centers. Because the assessment is what we need 300% energy output by 2029 just to meet the electrical demand for the data centers that are currently being built and that are in operation. I think there's some White House recommendations out there recently that said if you're building your own AI data center, you need to have your own power. Now, if you're not connected to the grid, Yeah, you're not NERC audited, but are they going to be NERC aligned? Not a bad idea, right? And so what are the investments that they're going to be putting into that? And so you think about a lot of these energy generation handles a little bit differently. It's a business different. Pause there. Energy generation versus distribution and transmission, right? They all have the same OT devices. They all have the same risk impacts, but they operate very differently from a business perspective. And so
absolutely.
Even understanding that in the energy space is a critical need that consultants and vendors need to have when targeting them as well.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, even within the same, you know, large power utility, they've got a different transmission versus a different distribution versus different power generation. Sometimes renewables are different, nuclear is different, you know, that they'll have oil and gas, they'll have all sorts of things under their portfolio, and they all have their different business units and they do things a little bit differently. The processes are different. The tech they use may be a little different. There's a lot of similarities across those things, but the risk to the business is different, how they respond. So all of those things, you know, when we look at those things, we have to consider and understand that to really, again, going back to the risk quantification and understanding of those things. And to your point of the things that as we're building out all this new power, I was literally looking at a thing this weekend in East Texas. They're building like a 5 gigawatt power plant that's something with Japan. I don't remember. I'll put the link in the show notes, but you know, they're doing it in a couple of places. One of them is in East Texas and another one's in Tennessee where it's a gas powered power plant, but it's a 5 gigawatt site. And you know, it's part of the Tokyo investment into the US, but are we thinking about all of this type of stuff and building all of these needs requirements? Are we building security into the process? Are we building compliance into the process? Because if we do it now, yeah, it's going to increase the capital cost of building the plant and onboarding it. But the long-term costs are way cheaper if I build it in now than it is later. Bolting on later is way more expensive, way less capable, way more difficult people process and technology-wise. So as we're building all these AI data centers, we need to be thinking about these things now, right? So how do we build those into our processes? How do we build the capabilities, the reporting, the quantification, the asset inventory, all of those things now, and integrate that into the larger scale of understanding the risk to this site and the overall AI data center. Power generation is a small part, but it's an important part that we need to understand. And it is a risk to the AI data center as they're building these things out.
And then, you know, 60% of those costs go to cooling, right? Just there as well. You know, I think that the why. Like, why do we need to build this up front? Why do we need to make the investments? I think, you know, whether it's AI data centers or you're deploying AI capabilities within generation, transmission, distribution, you know, these types of governance programs are harder, whether it's AI or OT or convergence of the two, more so than IT, because failure has physical consequence, right? This AI and OT isn't a tooling decision. It's a safety decision. Versus, you know, all these AI solutions that are out there that are GPT wrappers or whatever the case may be for marketing or HR, right? How many different ways are there? I look at first line, second line, third line of defense, right? To use a banking term, first line being operations, second being security risk and identity, and third being audit, to simplify again. First line defense investments. How many different ways are there to onboard an employee, to order a laptop, to reset a password, even to provision a server? I mean, I'm sure it's more than one, but it's not hundreds, right? When you think about ways to identify risk, communicate risk, how you talk about risk, the taxonomies, the nomenclature, right? Risk business impact, risk criticality. I mean, it's almost infinite amount of ways to pay depending on business industry, business services, business geography. And there's so many ways to do that I think, and OT's very similar. We talked about earlier, those PLCs or these brushless motors, they could be used for, you know, opening the gate or putting that landing gear into play, right? Or they could be used for, you know, opening hydroelectric power plant valves, or just unlocking a door, you know? And so what is that perspective? I think we're going to see a big need for entry level positions in risk and in security and in OT specifically, I think you'll see less hiring in first line of defense jobs. And people will start using AI to do those things, right? But it's a really interesting overlap. You know, maybe it's a conversation for another day, but when you think about an ERC engineer coming in, and does that person have Meta glasses on while they're doing the job, right? Where does that data go, right? Where does that sensitive and not classified, but regulated data go? There's all these examples of recently they found out there was another country outside of the US that was reviewing all the film from so many people's Meta AI glasses, right? You saw with the Waymos in San Francisco, right? When the power went out, there was impact there. And they found out that there's people in another country, not in the US, not US regulated, that were watching the video and helping those cars direct them in complex situations. You know, it goes on and on and on. And like, I kind of give you this little story here, wrap up on this. I sat down for lunch recently with the CISO, and he walks in and he's got his Meta glasses on. And we're staring at me, and there's two cameras like staring at me. I was like, hey, are those on? Oh no, I turned them off. I'm like, hey, just would you mind not wearing this where we have a conversation? And he's like, oh well, I actually took them in and had my prescription lenses put in here. So I kind of need them. I'm like, okay. Right. Conversation starts normal, goes into, so how do you feel about this Iran situation? Right. You know, it's like, whoa, where'd that come from? How do you feel about this geopolitical issue or that geopolitical? What about these regulators? And what about these US politicians? And I'm just sitting there giving vanilla answers, right? Just not these things are on. And what I realized was trust needs privacy and relationships need trust. And you need relationships to work with companies to build these security systems and AI and OT and IT convergence programs. And what is that? That was just at a lunch. Right? Where you're like, there's lack of privacy, there's lack of trust, and you can't have a real world conversation. And when you think about these situations in not only lunch, but in operational systems, at power plants, at substations, at areas where they have sensitive data, and right, NERC regulators won't even let you put PCSI data in the cloud, even with
right.
Using advanced encryption and FedRAMP High, they're still not even allowing that. What about the engineers wearing wearables going in here? Whole different podcast, maybe for a whole different day. But it's a really interesting thing, because is that an OT device, right? Are these AI recording things that people put on the back of their phone? Where does that data go? You know, they save and paying for these things. Most people aren't asking. Most salespeople aren't asking. They're not following policies. And are these IoT devices likely, right? Are they devices if someone's wearing them into a NERC environment? Right, where there's data that they're reading or looking through. Man, it's a slippery slope, but there's a great opportunity. And just full circle back to why your question, why should people be building these inventories, these policies, these controls, these reporting engines in the beginning of building these plants, to have as much governance and oversight as possible, because that's how we're going to lower the cost for regulation reporting. That's how we're going to lower the cost for automated compliance reporting, by starting early versus trying to stitch it all together on the back end.
Absolutely. Man, this has been a wealth of deep dive of that. And yeah, it sounds like we need to have another conversation and dive deeper into some of these topics. So how can people find you guys? Tell us a little bit about, you know, your company and what you guys do. How can people engage with you guys, et cetera?
Sure. So TemplarShield.com. Our website, you know, we are an enterprise risk management advisory consulting and tech enabled services firm. And we typically work with, you know, large mid market or large enterprises. That may change when you come to some water authorities or some co-op utilities trying to help them do what they need to do with limited resources. So that's another area we work in. We focus on a few industries. So it's critical infrastructure. So oil and gas, energy utility, transportation, telco, manufacturing. We do have a banking, financial services, and insurance vertical, because I do think that is part of critical infrastructure for society. And healthcare, life sciences, and public sector are our main areas. We don't do consumer goods, not a lot of retail. We try to focus on our company's purpose and mission is to support the backbone of society, right? And those services that support them. So TemplarShield.com is a great place. You can follow us on LinkedIn, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, socials. I try to put out little bits of information here and there, but that's where you'll see webinars. That's where you'll see us at conferences. You know, we ran into each other at S4, but we're also at, you know, CS4CA in Houston recently. We were in Marseille recently. We'll be at most of the industry conferences that focus on OT convergence into AI and traditional IT systems.
Love it, man. Well, definitely check them out. They have the experience and obviously, as you heard through this conversation, the knowledge that can help you and your organization really dive into these very complex things of categorizing and understanding the risks in our environment, which is so critical. Like, again, I don't mean to harp, but it doesn't matter what tools I have. If I don't know how to use them and I'm not plugging them in, I'm not, you know, nobody's using them. They're not configured. They're not deployed. Like all these things matter. And they can help you understand where I need to spend my money, where I need to get the most value with people, process, technology, be able to have conversations with the board to be able to get funding approval. Like all of these things are tied back into this conversation we just had today. It's extremely important that your organization do this at least variably well. And the better that you do it, the better off that your organization, your programs, everything else will be. So Nicholas, thank you for your time today, man. I really appreciate it. Amazing deep dive into this. And definitely I see us having another conversation and deeper dive in the future. So if you're willing, I'll definitely bring you back and we can have some more conversations.
Sounds great. I'll find some time to do that when we're not on site or traveling, right? But it's great to see you. Thanks for having me. And I look forward to the next one.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Take care.
Thanks for joining us on Protect It All, where we explore the crossroads of IT and OT cybersecurity. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to stay ahead in this ever-evolving field. Until next time.